under the command of Robert Blake, had won so many victories against Holland and Spain that the crews of British ships proudly lashed brooms to their mastheads in recognition of having swept the channel clean of enemy vessels. Now that Charles II was back on the throne, it was left to them, the militiamen of Puritan New England, to maintain the twin traditions of spiritual purity and martial prowess in the face of an ungodly foe. There was yet another legacy for these soldiers to consider that night at the Miles garrison. 38 years before, many of their fathers had served in the Pequot War. The Indians' bows and arrows had proven ludicrously ineffective in the face of English matchlocks, and victory had come in what seemed a single God-ordained stroke at the massacre at Mystic. It was true that the Indians had since armed themselves with flintlocks, but the assumption remained that a single Englishman was worth at least 10 Indians in battle, the previous day's outcome notwithstanding. The combined Plymouth and Massachusetts Bay forces assembled at the Miles garrison possessed the same equipment and training then current in Europe, where orderly lines of soldiers gathered on open battlefields and fired at one another, often with as little as 50 yards between them. In this kind of fighting, an old matchlock, which was so heavy that a wooden stand was required to prop up the muzzle, was perfectly suitable. The soldier was not expected to aim his weapon at anyone or anything in particular. In fact, the matchlock possessed no sight. Instead, the musketeer was trained to fire in the general direction of the enemy in a coordinated volley. Just as important in European warfare as the musketeer was the pikeman, a soldier who wielded a 14-foot-long spear. Pikemen led charges against an enemy line. They also provided a form of defense against a cavalry charge. By driving the butts of their pikes into the ground, the pikemen created a temporary fortress behind which the musketeers could reload their weapons. Already, New England's militia had begun to alter their equipment and tactics in ways that were well ahead of Europe. Flintlocks were more popular in America than in Europe, where matchlocks were used in battle as late as 1700. The example of the Indians, who used their flintlocks to such good effect in hunting deer, bear, and other game, was impossible to ignore. But old habits died hard, and on the morning of Tuesday, June 29th, many of the soldiers still possessed matchlocks and pikes, weapons that soon proved completely ineffective in fighting an enemy that refused to meet them in the open field. That morning, Moseley and his privateers led the way across the bridge. Schooled in the brutal, haphazard world of hand-to-hand combat on a ship's deck, these sailors were, it turned out, much better adapted than the militiamen to fighting Indians. 10 of the enemy could be seen on the opposite side of the river, about a half mile away, shouting insults at the English. Not at all daunted by such kind of alarms, Moseley and his men ran violently down upon them over the bridge, pursuing them a mile and a quarter on the other side. As Moseley's volunteers chased the Indians until they had disappeared into a swamp, killing, it was later reported, about a half dozen of them, Church was forced to participate in a more traditional military operation. Fanning out in two wings, the troopers created a long line intended to sweep the area of Indians while protecting the foot soldiers in the middle. Unfortunately, the center of the line was, in Church's judgment, not well headed. With visibility diminished in the rain, some of the soldiers mistook their comrades for the enemy, and one of the troopers, a 20-year-old ensign named Perez Savage, who boldly held up his colors in the front of his company, was shot not once but twice, one ball harmlessly piercing the brim of his hat and the other hitting him in the thigh. With the weather getting worse by the moment and no Indians in sight, although several officers insisted that Savage had been hit by native fire, it was decided to return to the garrison for the night. The next day, the English forces were in no hurry to march on Mount Hope, where as many as 500 native warriors were said to be waiting for them. Not until noon did the English head out once again across the bridge. The previous day, they had ventured only a mile and a half into enemy territory. This time, they continued on to the English settlement at Kikemuit. Tensions were already high among the militiamen. What they saw at Kikemuit made them only more apprehensive of what lay ahead. the abandoned houses had been all burned. But even more disturbing than the blackened and smoking remnants of a once thriving community were the pieces of paper seen fluttering in the air, paper that soon proved to be the torn pages of a Bible. For this overwhelmingly Puritan force, it was a shocking outrage to know that the Indians had ripped apart this most sacred of books and scattered God's words to the winds in hatred of our religion. Then, 3 miles later, they discovered the remains of 8 Englishmen killed 5 days earlier at the nearby settlement of Mattapoisett. The Indians had mounted the men's heads, scalps, and hands on poles and planted them beside the roadside in what one commentator described as a barbarous and inhuman manner bidding us defiance. The body parts were quickly buried, and the soldiers continued on. 2 miles later, they reached the Poconocuts village. One of the first on the scene was the giant Dutch pirate Cornelis Anderson. It was apparent that the Indians had left in a hurry. Cooking utensils had been left scattered on the ground, and at Philip's own wigwam, the Dutchman found what several local residents recognized as the sachem's hat, a hat that Anderson placed triumphantly on his own huge head. The Poconocuts had also left their drums behind, but not before carefully staving in each one. Spreading out almost as far as the eye could see was an estimated 1,000 acres of Indian corn. Soon the soldiers began uprooting every stalk. If they could not defeat the Indians in battle, they would do their best to starve them to death. Some of Philip's pigs were found rooting in the mud. There were also a large number of newly masterless native dogs. Philip's horse, identifiable by its distinctive saddle, was found wandering the fields of Mount Hope. But nowhere was there a single Indian. Church knew immediately what had happened. So as not to become trapped on the peninsula, Philip and his people had transported themselves by canoes across the sound to Pocasset, not an easy feat given that the water surrounding Mount Hope was supposedly being guarded by vessels from Rhode Island. Once in Pocasset, Philip had met up with Weetamoo, who now had no choice but to join her brother-in-law. Church recognized it as a brilliant tactical move. Not only did Philip now have a more advantageous post, he was stronger than he'd ever been. Church's commanders, however, chose to see Philip's flight from Mount Hope as a mighty conquest on their part. They had driven the Poconocuts from their homeland. Church urged his superiors to pursue Philip immediately. If the sachem should break out of Pocasset, all of New England might soon be at war. But the Plymouth commander, James Cudworth, insisted that they must first comb every inch of the Mount Hope Peninsula for Indians. Then it was decided that the army should build a fort on the site of Philip's village to make sure the Poconocuts did not return to Mount Hope. From Church's perspective, it was nothing but busy work designed to postpone the time when the English must finally face the Indians in battle. "'Twas rather their fear than their courage," Church wrote, "that obliged them to set up the marks of their conquest." While the Plymouth forces built a useless fort, the Massachusetts authorities committed an even larger tactical blunder. Instead of sending Moseley and the others after Philip, they decided it was time to turn their attention to the Narragansetts. There were legitimate concerns that the tribe might be preparing to join Philip in the war. Some of the Poconocuts' women and children, it was rumored, had sought shelter with the Narragansetts. In truth, however, there was no clear evidence that the tribe had any hostile intentions toward the English. The Narragansetts, like all the other tribes in New England, were watching Philip's rebellion very closely. In the beginning, they assumed the conflict was a local affair between Philip and Plymouth. But with the arrival of soldiers from Massachusetts Bay, the Narragansetts began to realize that the English regarded the rebellion in broader terms. Even though Massachusetts Bay had no complaints against Philip, the Puritans had quickly come to their neighbor's defense. Even Rhode Island, which both Plymouth and Massachusetts normally scorned, had offered to help. The Narragansetts demanded why the Massachusetts and Rhode Island rose and joined with Plymouth against Philip, Roger Williams wrote on June 25th, and left not Philip and Plymouth to fight it out. We answered that all the colonies were subject to one King Charles, and it was his pleasure and our duty and engagement for one Englishman to stand to the death by each other in all parts of the world. By immediately assuming the conflict was a racial rather than a political struggle, the English were, in effect, creating a self-fulfilling prophecy. As the magnitude of the English response increased, Indians across New England discovered that instead of considering them valued allies, the English had suddenly begun to regard them all as potential foes. Perhaps Philip was right. Their only option was war. But there were other factors besides racial fear and national loyalty influencing the Massachusetts Bay officials' decision to send the militia to Rhode Island. Both Massachusetts and Connecticut had designs on obtaining large tracts of land in the western portion of Rhode Island. The Massachusetts Bay leaders decided that they must seize the opportunity to make their military presence known in Rhode Island, and so, under the pretext of securing a treaty with the Narragansetts, the Massachusetts forces left Mount Hope for the western shore of the bay, where they did their best to intimidate both the Indians and the English, whose lands the Puritans coveted. The end result of this misbegotten strategy was to turn what had most probably been a neutral tribe into an increasingly hostile one. For his part, Church had not given up on his original hope of winning both Weetamoo and Awashonks over to the English side. He was convinced that if he'd been able to speak to the sachems before the outbreak of hostilities, they would have spurned Philip. Even if it was too late to keep the Pocassets and Seconnets out of the war, there was nothing to be accomplished by remaining at Mount Hope. The Plymouth authorities, however, seemed intent on keeping him on the west side of Mount Hope Bay. His elderly father-in-law, Constance Southworth, requested that he assume his duties as Commissary General of the Plymouth Militia. Instead of doing something that might bring an end to the war, whether it was through diplomacy or fighting Philip, he was now forced to attend to the mundane tasks of feeding an army of several hundred men. There was one officer, however, who agreed with Church that it was time to move into Pocasset. Matthew Fuller was the army's Surgeon General. Although he was, in his own words, too ancient and heavy to be chasing Indians, he asked Church if he'd go with him to Pocasset. Church responded that he had rather do anything in the world than stay there to build the fort. So on the night of Thursday, July 8th, after taking the ferry that ran from the southern tip of Mount Hope to Aquidneck Island, Fuller, Church, and just 36 men were transported by boat to the shores of Pocasset. After a night spent sleeping in the countryside, they were off in search of Indians. While Fuller went north with half the men, Church took the other half south toward his home in Seconnet. With luck, he might make contact with Awashonks. Several hours later, his men began to complain that they had not yet found any of the Indians he had promised them. As they made their way along the shore of the Seconnet River, Church assured them that if it was their desire to see Indians, he believed he should now soon show them what they should say was enough. 55 years earlier, Miles Standish had led a similar patrol along the south shore of Cape Cod. The Pilgrims' search for Indians had been part of a voyage of discovery to a new and unknown land. Church was conducting his search just a few miles from his own farm, a land made just as new and strange by the transformative power of war. They could see signs of recent Indian activity all around them, a network of sinuous trails that crisscrossed the woods and fields. They came upon a wigwam loaded with cooking utensils and clothing. A few of the men asked if they could take some of the goods with him, but Church forbade it, telling them they might expect soon to have their hands full with Indians instead of plunder. On Punkatee's Neck, between a ridge of dense forest and the stony shore of the Seconnet River, they found a newly cultivated field of peas. They also saw two Indians walking through the field toward them. When the Indians turned and started to run, Church called out that he only wanted to talk and would not hurt them. But the Indians continued to run, with Church and his men in pursuit. There was a fence between the field and the woods, and as the Indians scrambled over it, one of them turned and fired his musket. A soldier fired back, and even though the Indians quickly disappeared into the woods, the English heard a strangled cry of pain suggesting that one of them had been hit. They followed the Indians into the woods. Suddenly, the sun-dappled darkness erupted with the roar of dozens of muskets firing simultaneously. Like many other English officers would do in the months ahead, Church had led his men into an ambush. He glanced back, expecting to have seen half of them dead, but all were still standing and firing blindly into the thick cloud of gray smoke that billowed toward them from the trees. Church ordered them to stop firing. If they discharged their muskets all at once, the Indians might charge them with their hatchets. It was time to retreat to the field. As soon as they reached the fence, Church ordered those who had not yet fired their muskets to hide themselves behind the fence while the others moved well into the field and reloaded. If the Indians should pursue them to the fence, there would be a trap waiting for them. Church was quickly learning how to use the Indians' own tactics of concealment and surprise against them. But when Church glanced back to the heavily wooded rise of land from which they'd just come, he immediately began to reevaluate his strategy. From where he stood, the wooded hill appeared to be moving. He soon realized that the rise of land was completely covered with Indians, their bright guns glittering in the sun as they poured out of the woods and onto the field. The field bordered the Saconnet River, and the Indians were attempting to surround the Englishmen before they reached the water's edge. Church quickly scanned the river. There were supposed to be several boats waiting to take them back to Aquidneck Island. On the other side of the river, less than a mile away, were some boats on the Aquidneck shore. They were too far away to be of much help now. Near the water were the remnants of a stone wall. He ordered his men to run across the field and take the wall before the Indians reached it. He also told them to strip down to their white shirts so that the men across the river would know that they were Englishmen. In order to get their attention, he ordered three of his men to fire their guns one after the other. Soon they were all dashing across the field, the Indians' bullets cutting through the leaves of the pea plants and sending up spurts of dust as the Englishmen threw themselves over an old hedge and tumbled down the bank to the wall beside the shore. Unfortunately, it was not much of a wall. As the Indians took up positions around them, using the ruins of an old stone house and any available stumps, rocks, trees, and fence posts for protection, Church and his men were left wide open to shots from the north and south. They grabbed whatever rocks they could find and began widening the wall. But their biggest problem was not a lack of protection, it was their lack of gunpowder. Church estimated that they were up against several hundred Indians, and there were only 20 of them. Once they ran out of powder, the Indians would be on them in a moment, and they would all be massacred. Church marveled at how his men bravely and wonderfully defended themselves in the face of such an overwhelming force. But there was reason for hope. A sloop had started to sail toward them from Aquidneck Island. But as soon as the vessel came to within hailing distance, the Indians turned their guns upon it. The wind was blowing onshore from the northwest, and Church asked the boat's master if he might send them the canoe that was tied to his stern so that they could use it to paddle back to his boat. But the sailor refused. One of Church's men cried out, "For God's sake, take us off! Our ammunition is spent!" This was not the kind of information Church wanted the Indians to know. It was time to end the conversation. Marshaling the same kind of fury he had displayed at the Miles garrison, he ordered the boat's master to either send his canoe ashore or else be gone presently, or he would fire upon him. The vessel promptly headed back for Aquidneck, and the Indians, reanimated by the boat's departure, fired thicker and faster than ever. Some of Church's men began to talk about making a run for it. Church insisted that their best chance at survival was to stay together. It was already a miracle that they were still alive. God, in his wonderful providence, had chosen to preserve them. Church was confident that no matter how bad it looked now, not a hair of their heads should fall to the ground if they continued to be patient, courageous, and prudently sparing of their ammunition. It was a soldier's version of predestination. God was in control, and he was on their side. One of the men had become so frightened that he was unable to fire his musket. Church ordered him to devote his energies to reinforcing the wall. As Church delivered his speech, the soldier was in the midst of laying a flat rock down in front of him when a bullet ricocheted off the stone's face. It was exactly the example Church needed. "Observe," he cried out to his men, "how God directed the bullets to hit the stone and not the man." Whether through providence or not, from that moment forward, everyone in his little army